Good morning. How could U.S.-flagged fishing vessels in Hawaii become floating prisons for the foreign workers employed by them? Maritime attorney Jay Friedheim helps us understand the legal convergence that produced it and what could happen next. Meanwhile, managing Papahana Makuakea, what's next for the expanded monument? We're going to talk with a California professor who studies historical park management and says how it can happen is a huge question. I'm Beth Ann Koslovich.
I'm Bill Sage. Gabriella Huli-Holt helps our Keiki listen to the ancient story. She joins us this morning. And it had to be you. No, wait, it should have been you. Manoa Valley Theater opens its 48th season with a hilarious new musical.
It's Monday, September 12th. That's The Conversation, and it starts right after this news. And a good Monday morning to you. I'm Beth Ann Koslovich, and welcome to The Conversation. Good morning, Bill Sage.
Good morning, Beth Ann. It's one of those Mondays where after everything that we were listening to at the IUCN conference last week and information about ocean conservation, it seems like this is one of those weeks when more will be revealed, especially in light of what to do about those fresh-caught fish.
Fresh-caught fish, and more to the point, who's fishing for them. Now, a situation brought to light last week in an AP article has many people wondering how in our state there could be foreign fishermen unable to get off the U.S.-flagged boats which employed them for years. The state of the fishermen is made possible by a complicated set of laws that created a loophole supported by the late Senator Daniel Inouye. The men are reported to be paid as little as 70 cents an hour, not allowed to be in possession of their papers, and are ineligible for immigrant visas, again, because of that loophole. Jay Friedheim is a longtime maritime attorney. In 2002, his efforts led to the arrest of a Chinese ship, the Full Means II, with a crew in similar circumstances. We asked Jay Friedheim to have a look at what's known about this case and help us navigate our understanding. Thank you very much, Jay, for coming in.
My pleasure.
So as we begin to look at this case, a lot of people seem to be scratching their heads over how, with our labor laws, this could happen, until you go back and look at some of those laws, Magnuson-Stevens, Jones Act, others that have brought this together, and the work of Senator Inouye to create in what was his mind, according to some, an economic opportunity, and this seems to be those unintended consequences.
I think you have it exactly right. It's the unintended consequences. Senator Inouye was doing something really wonderful for Hawaii. Preceding this solution that he came with, you called it a loophole, but it's really a solution, the entire longline fleet left Hawaii and went down to Fiji and Samoa. Maybe $110 to $150 million worth of fish that's going on these auction blocks left, and we wanted to bring it back. You mentioned the Jones Act. People complain about the Jones Act in shipping, but the Jones Act requires that an American vessel be owned, operated, manned by Americans, repaired at American facilities, or it cannot be an American bottom. The difference between an American vessel and a foreign vessel is an American vessel can go in and out of port. A foreign vessel has to go from an American port to a foreign country and then back to an American port. And we're the most remote island group in the world. So Christmas Island is the closest place you can do that and be a foreign vessel. They don't have those problems in Fiji and Samoa. So the senator looked at the situation and said, hey, we're the most remote island group in the world, and we need to be able to have this fishing fleet here. And he created a situation that was a slight tweak on the Jones Act. The situation is, though, that these workers arrive here by boat. And so the federal government, you know, like Florence Nakakuni, she says, hey, you know, they're not allowed to come offshore. They're not going through immigration. So it's not that, you know, she's concerned about the problem, but what can be done? They're then on the vessels, not able to get off to go and go to Waikiki, go to a movie, do whatever.
And that's because they don't have visas.
They don't have visas.
And they're not allowed to have visas because they're not staying here for an extended period of time. They're just working on the American vessels.
Therein lies the rub. What's the problem here? The problem is that these workers, they don't have a life. They come in, the jobs that they're getting are desired jobs. They want these jobs. And there's maybe 700 to 1,000 of them. There were probably 1,500 American workers on these vessels. There are very few American workers anymore because...
And you say that they want these jobs. Why? Because they get economic security in a way that they don't have at home?
Where they come from, this is a good job. Like from China, to get $350 a month, which is what they're promised when they sign on, that's a year's worth of earnings for these farm people out in the boonies in China. This is a great opportunity for them.
But having said that, though, to use that as justification for paying them less than you'd pay an American worker or not to offer them the same conditions that American workers are afforded seems to be a hollow argument.
Well, the reason the fleet left was because they couldn't afford to hire the American workers and pay them benefits. Here's the deal. Foreign workers means lower pay, no benefits. That's why we outsource all these things. And that's really what we're talking about here is we've outsourced this American labor to foreign nationals who are not able to get off the boat when they're here.
So, Jay, what's a remedy for this as you look at
it? To me, it's an admiralty problem. The traditional maritime remedies, which go back to the ancient kingdom of Hawaii here in a very real way, this was a big concern to Queen Emma and King Liholiho. They created rules that when these foreign seamen were left on shore here, the boats had to put up money to pay for their medical care, to take care of them. They housed them in, while they were being treated and taken care of. The money to build Queen's Hospital comes from the fact that the kingdom levied a tax on these vessels, and that tax was used to pay for their medical care, and eventually it produced our Queen's Hospital. So it's a real big part of our history and what we have going on here. What's the remedy, though? Traditional maritime remedies, maintenance and cure, that the ship and the vessel owner owes the injured seaman the right to get medical care and a few dollars a day to live on. Repatriation. If they get hurt, they get sent back to their home. That was a big deal in the Kingdom of Hawaii when these foreign American, they were Americans, but there were foreign seamen getting hurt, being left in Maui. That's where the Damon Seamen's Church comes from and all this stuff. Big part of our tradition. maintenance and cure, wages, and repatriation. Those remedies are enforced through the federal courts. The federal courts used to take this very seriously. In Hawaii, our judiciary is not so concerned. They're more interested in maybe the commercial aspects of what's going on than the humanitarian aspects of getting an injured seaman their maintenance and cure. It's not just these foreign workers. We have cases of American workers who get hurt, who are unable to get their medical care paid for or a few dollars a day to live on. I've got cases that have been going on for years that now are costing me into the almost $100,000 we've spent to try to get one American worker maintenance and cure.
We only have about a minute or so left, and I wanted to ask you, though, that when you're talking about all the things that you just mentioned, those are very tangible situations. But when you're talking about somebody's psychological health, their mental health, we still have trouble in general talking about mental health in the same way as we talk about physical health and not being allowed off a ship to be able to maybe spend
stressful.
Some of that money or to being able to do anything that would give them, as you call it, a life. Well, what happens in that circumstance?
Well, the question is, how do you fix the underlying condition? America solved this problem through unions. Our unions look out for the workers, make sure that they're given a reasonable wage, collective bargaining. That doesn't happen in their own countries. And here, when the ILWU tried to organize these fishermen, it never worked. So that's how we usually solve these problems, collective bargaining. The people get together, they argue and work for better rights.
So for these workers, what's the remedy that you see that might be the next place we go?
It's individuals like myself are willing to go into court and fight for their rights. It's just becoming increasingly difficult to try to get access to justice through the federal system for these seamen's rights.
And what about with the businesses themselves, the fisheries themselves?
Well, the fish, you know, these people didn't go into business to oppress workers. They went into business to catch fish. You need men to do the fishing. And where are those men going to come from?
So we shouldn't be expecting for them to do any of those things that you just mentioned.
Well, we should. They have bottom line obligations under maritime law to take care of their workers, give them humane conditions. Most of these problems are really employment issues. You know, is it safe to work? Is it healthy to work?
Jay Friedheim, thank you so much for coming in. I know you'll be watching this case with interest, and we'll be talking to you about it as we also watch it. Thank you.
Thank you for this opportunity.
Jay Friedheim is the founder and lead attorney of Admiralty Advocates. He's been practicing maritime law in Honolulu for nearly 30 years. He primarily represents injured maritime workers who work on vessels and on piers, loading and unloading ships. He doesn't represent any of the foreign fishermen in this case.
Staying after school is not for extra credit.
And he would say, Mr. Gill, do I have to go home? I really don't want to go home. It used to affect me greatly when I would have to say, no, I have to go now.
How a teacher tried and failed with one young man and what it taught him about everyone's responsibility to help young people at risk. Next time on The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI Public Radio International.
This morning at 9, right after The Conversation.
This is The Conversation on member-supported HPR2. It's 8:15. Coming up, it should have been you. But first, a formerly incurable backyard quiz.
A little history in today's backyard quiz. As you may remember from a previous quiz, the 1899 bubonic plague outbreak in Honolulu's Chinatown led not only to the disastrous Chinatown fire, but also the establishment of a temporary hospital in an old kerosene warehouse in Kaka'ako to care for the dying. Once the plague had been contained, the temporary medical center became known as the Victoria Hospital Association, and it took on tuberculosis patients and all other people suffering from incurable diseases, all except those suffering from what was then known as leprosy, later called Hansen's disease. Early 20th century medicine considered that one too dangerous to treat on Oahu, and Hansen's victims were still shipped to Kalaupapa on Molokai. Meanwhile, the Victoria Hospital in Kaka'ako continued to treat other incurable diseases, and in August of 1901, it was given a new name, the Honolulu Home for Incurables. It changed locations in 1902, and by 1906, its name was thought a bit much for the morale of patients, staff, and families, and this facility took on the name it bears to this day. And we'd like to know if you know what it is. If you do, call us at 941-3689 or 877-941-3689. And the first one with the right answer will get the T-shirt.
Support for The Conversation comes from Hawaii Life Real Estate Brokers, serving Oahu, Maui, Kauai, and the Big Island of Hawaii. Listings and information at hawaiilife.com.
In olden days, a glimpse of stocking was looked on as something shocking, but now God knows anything goes. I don't want to give away the plot, but Manoa Valley Theater is opening its 48th season with a 21st century musical underscoring the universal human truth that the more things change, the more they stay the same. Or maybe you could put it this way. Is everybody nuts on their wedding day? Manoa Valley Theater's director and producer of the show, It Should Have Been You, is with us. A story, a typical story, a nice Jewish bride, a nice Catholic groom. What could possibly go wrong? Good morning, Dwight.
Good morning. How are you?
Well, so far, I survived a wedding and nothing went wrong, so I just would like to know about this wedding you're serving up at MVT.
Well, I'll tell you, it's the perfect wedding in which nothing goes right.
Ah.
And it is hilarious. It is a wonderful musical comedy from the 2015 Broadway season about two families. They're very different, and they come together to wed a member of each family, and what quickly happens is the perfectly planned wedding dissolves into chaos and mania, and allegiances are reformed, and secrets are revealed, and everything shifts around, and it turns out to be quite a hilarious event.
So we have the 48th season for Manoa Valley Theater. A little quick background. This was the theater in the graveyard, so to speak.
Still is. We still have Ohana just outside the front door.
Uh-huh.
It's delightful. It's actually land owned by Kwaihau Church, and the theater's been on that location since 1972. It went up in its third year of existence, and it's become our home. And we have a 165-seat black box theater and do some wonderful shows from Broadway and off-Broadway. And we use community members in all the talent positions. And it's very dynamic and very exciting.
So this is the cast, I mean, the set. I don't want to give away too much of the plot, because by the time you get to the end of it, everybody in the audience is probably going to be wringing themselves out with laughter and tears of, oh, yeah, I remember that, at my, or just whatever's happening. But without giving away too much, can you set up some of those little teasers which make us just say, oh, yeah, that I can identify with?
Well, everyone has a past.
Yes.
And the two intended nuptials have their own unique pasts that their families don't know about. And allegiances shift in the course of trying to put together this wedding.
Mm-hmm.
And we find that other people really had relationships before, and that they are informing this new relationship that's about to take place. And it's very funny. It's not a manic farce like In and Out of Slamming Doors, but it's right up to that point. And it's just hilarious to see how people adapt to this new information of who is who and who likes who and who doesn't like who.
One might say that musical comedy is, like with many comedies, a way of coming to grips with basic human, shall we say, foibles, or just the ability to not really cope, possibly. Do you think the show would come out as a coping mechanism for many people in the audience?
It might. Whether it's a wedding or a graduation or a birthday. I mean, how many of us have planned what we hope is going to be the perfect event? Nothing could go wrong. And that pretty much is a way to get things started where everything does start going wrong.
So who do you have in the cast?
We've got a wonderful cast. Shari Lynn is in it. She's very well known in the entertainment community. And Howard Bishop and Cowley Doan and Dusty Boehner and Matthew Mazzella and a whole bunch of folks who are familiar faces on Hawaii stages, not just Manoa Valley Theater. It's a top-rate cast, and it's a tightly written show. The music is delightful. Bree Peters is our guest director. Kip Wilborn is our guest musical director. And they've really assembled a terrific team of people. And I think it's going to be a riot. I really do.
As you went through the rehearsals, did any members of the I'm just curious, because so much of the backstory, once it is revealed on stage, I just think there's going to be so many aha moments. But did members of your cast find themselves, as they're rehearsing, going, oh, does it really hit home for members of the cast without giving away?
Well, you could see in people's faces that everyone has their own secrets and things that maybe they haven't totally revealed to others. And, of course, art imitates life.
Yes, imitating and, life, imitating
and,
art.
And an actor has to draw from themselves in order to find those particular qualities that they use to embellish and enhance their characters. So I'm sure there's a little bit of realism from the actors that comes through in the show.
When did you first notice that? The first run-through after auditions?
It probably started when they were coming to the auditions, and you saw as people walked in that you could read in people's faces that they had backstory too.
Aha. So we might say for the people of the potential audience, everybody here will find yet another coping mechanism for the fact that we humans tend to find ourselves in situations which we contributed to or which we are trying to extricate others from. Might that be a delicate way to put it?
I think that's a very delicate way of putting it. Okay. I do indeed. You know, the show was directed on Broadway by David Hyde Pierce, who most of your listeners will know as Niles on TV's Frasier. And we know about his sense of humor. while he didn't write the show, I'm sure that there are many characteristics that he put into it that we will find also in our production.
I have a feeling that some of the people who wrote and direct this had the same been there, done that when they put it to paper and then
probably so. Many times comedy comes from personal tragedies, and I don't know about these two particular authors. They've been in touch with our theater. They're very excited about us opening this show on Thursday. So maybe we'll have a chance to talk story with them and see if this reflects their pasts.
Well, I have a feeling that what it will do is let people who look at it give a chance to cope better with things in their own life and make the whole human experience bearable and even better once they figure it out.
I hope so.
Thanks so much for being with us this morning.
Thank you very much.
Dwight Martin is the producing director of It Should Have Been You, running September 15th through October 2nd. See our Facebook page, Hawaii Conversation, for more details.
The U.S. Department of Housing and Urban Development is investigating a complaint that Honolulu doesn't provide enough affordable housing units for people with disabilities. That despite what the Housing Authority's director says his department has already done to increase those units, Civil Beat editor and general manager Patty Epler joins us now with today's Reality Check. Good morning.
Good morning, Beth Ann. How are you?
Not bad, thanks. Good to talk to you. So disability rights advocates have long pointed to the fact that we don't have enough units that would be geared for people who have disabilities. And now we have a lawsuit. Why now?
So it's not quite a lawsuit yet. The
I'm sorry, I misspoke. Not a lawsuit, but they're investigating the complaint that was lodged with HUD.
Yes, that's what's going on. Louis Erdachuk from the Hawaii Disability Rights Center believes that the Hawaii Public Housing Authority is falling short of the number of units that should be available to people with disabilities. And that's simply what's going on, is he wants HUD to investigate whether that, in fact, is the case or not. And so it's sort of a precursor, I think, to legal action. And legal action has been going on all over the country in terms of trying to get more housing, public housing for disabled people. But I think even though the Hawaii Public Housing Authority says it has significantly improved its percentage of housing that's available for the disabled, there are other attorneys and other folks who work with the disabled who say it's constant problems, you know, that they just can't get their folks in. So
so can
I think
we talk some of the numbers
worth
there?
Investigating it.
Yes, let's talk some of the numbers, because when you talk about raw units that are supposed to be available, wasn't that there somewhere around 5% that are supposed to be available, but we're a little bit under that, sort of, kind of?
So the public Housing Authority says that they have a total of 5,926 units. Of those, 251 are accessible for disabled people. And that would be 4.2% of the units. But I believe it's the threshold they need to hit is they're trying to get to 5%, and legally they need at least 2%. So they're sort of, you know, in there somewhere. Now, the Hawaii Public Housing Authority director told Anita Hofschneider, a reporter, that in addition to the 251, there are 100 others that are being renovated right now. So they believe that's a good amount.
Did Hakeem Wonsafi, the executive director of the Housing Authority, say when those additional 100 units will come online?
He did not, but he believes that they're in the works now and won't be too long.
How long do people who are disabled in general have to wait? Is there any sense of that they are waiting longer, that they are not treated the same way that others have been treated in waiting for an affordable housing unit?
Well, I think there have been complaints about that people are waiting so long, months and months and months, that there's a fear that it's contributing to the homeless population, and that people just aren't able to get in even to the units that may be available now.
Okay. Well, I guess we're going to wait and see how this one plays out and if it is, as you suggest, perhaps a precursor to a lawsuit. But I thought perhaps we were already there. Thanks very much.
All right, Beth Ann, thank you.
We're going to talk to you tomorrow. Patty's going to be joining us all week. Thanks very much.
You are so lucky.
Yeah, we are. Patty Epler is the editor and general manager of Civil Beat. She's also the editor-in-chief of HuffPost Hawaii.
Support for Hawaii Public Radio comes from the National Kidney Foundation of Hawaii, striving to increase awareness and treatment of kidney diseases affecting 1 in 7 Hawaii residents. Learn more at kidneyhi.org.
Now that the hoopla over the expansion of the Papahānaumokuakea Marine National Monument is over, how to manage an ocean park about the size of Alaska is just as big a question. It's one that worries a California professor who studies the history and management of marine sanctuaries, national forest parks, and refuges in California and the West. Char Miller is the W.M. Keck Professor of Environmental Analysis at Pomona College in Claremont, California. He just published a book, Not So Golden State, Sustainability versus the California Dream, which explores some of the ethical, environmental, and economic dilemmas of park management. Professor Miller, welcome to the conversation.
Thank you so much. It's great to be on.
Papahānaumokuakea is literally a different situation than we've had before, given the fact that it's so huge. But you say that a lot of the same issues that we're facing with it have been faced by other parks and marine monuments, even what we had before the expansion. And that worries you greatly. Why?
Well, I guess I'm worried, concerned. Let's call it concerned, in part because some of these concerns are budgetary. A marine sanctuary the size of this one, close to the size of Alaska, is pretty impressive until you ask, how are they actually going to pay for its management? And some of it also has to do with the ways in which that management, as best people can work it out, actually ties into the longstanding, and now we're talking 120-year history of public lands managements in the United States, whether it's on land or water, in which you've really got to build trust with the community that surrounds it. And I know about the controversy, of course, about the foundation of this or the expansion process of this sanctuary. And honestly, that was as true in the 1890s anywhere in the West where the beginnings of this process occurred, in Colorado and California, Oregon, and the like.
So give us an example of what that like situation looked
please.
Like then and why we can potentially look at the same situation now, maybe only with a greater magnitude.
Well, the politics were really intense, I have to say, and it was not so well publicly managed as I think this expansion was. There were no public hearings. They simply declared a national forest a national forest, and then people around it went, what happened? And so exploded in anger. The early part of the 20th century was a political bloodbath when they tried to create the public lands. The national parks that then would later come in were probably not as well managed. And I have to say, one of the things that Hawaii has done brilliantly in this process, and it's a reflection in the marine sanctuary, is that much of the decisions in the past were top-down, and this one is bottom-up. however controversial, people on the ground were supporting this. And the fact that the Department of Hawaiian Affairs is engaged is, to my mind, precedent-setting. So in some ways, we're looking at something entirely new. And in some ways, I think there's a long history from which we can draw some conclusions.
Before you draw some of those conclusions, though, because you mentioned the Office of Hawaiian Affairs and the fact that it's now going to have a real management hand in Papahānaumokuakea, why does that or make that a better situation in your mind or potentially one that's more fraught, depending upon how you look at it?
Oh, yeah, that's great. So when something is better, it's always fraught. Right, you can never get entirely one or the other. But I will say that the Obama administration has brokered, in this case, in the tiny national monument by comparison in Maine, Katahdin, Woods and Waters National Monument, that was announced the exact same week, to incorporate indigenous voices in the management of these two national monuments. And in the past, to be honest, the National Park Service, the Forest Service, and others dispossessed indigenous peoples to create national forests, to create the national parks. And the Obama administration, to its credit, is pushing in a new direction. So that's better. The fraughtness, in a sense, for whoever manages this vast place, is that there's a lot more voices now telling you what you should be doing. But I think that's how democracy functions. When everyone has a voice at the table, those voices are heard. And whatever compromises result, it seems to me that's what makes democracy work best of all.
It's not just obviously in the United States, though. We heard a great deal about the rights of indigenous peoples to begin to shape and safeguard sacred sites and lands which were historic sites. All that said, though, you're still talking about the bottom line of this is how do you manage a park this large and how is the money going to come to be able to fund it? Because we've seen a number of cases where there have been very good ideas put out there, even things that have been codified in law, but no money to be able to see their implementation. And that leaves the door open to a lot of abuse.
It leaves the door open to a lot of abuse or frankly, degradation. And I would say that let's go directly to the act that President Obama utilized and President Bush did to create and expand this marine reserve. The Antiquities Act was founded and it was started in 1906. It gave the president unilateral power to name things a national monument. But it contained no mechanism by which to fund these things. For the first 30 to 40 years, well into the 1930s and the 1940s, presidents named national monuments, and Congress barely gave the new National Park Service any money to manage them. And so these sites, while we now laud them for their creation, basically had almost no one overseeing them. This is going to be a different case, obviously, since you know, NOAA and Fish and Wildlife Service, the state, and the Office of Hawaiian Affairs all will be looking at this landscape. But I haven't seen a budget that came with it. And let's frame it up against the Katahdin one, which is unusual in its own right. It was a private property owner who gave 87,000 acres to the federal government and then a $40 million endowment. That's never happened before.
Right.
It may never happen again. But that's what we're looking at. If you're going to create something the size of Alaska, shouldn't it have a budget that's commensurate with its vast extent? I would say yes. It's not clear to me that Congress will say yes as well.
Well, and we're going to have to wait and see what happens after an administration changes and where we go from here. But I want to thank you very much for joining us this morning and giving us some historical context as well as a great many things to think about in preserving something that a lot of people on our side of the microphone over here and our side of the ocean are quite happy about. Thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you, Beth Allen, so much.
Char Miller is the W.M. Keck Professor of Environmental Analysis at Pomona College in Claremont, California. His just published book, Not So Golden State, Sustainability versus the California Dream, looks at some of the ethical, environmental, and economic dilemmas that are complicating the management of marine sanctuaries, national forests, parks, and refuges in California and the West.
Aloha, I'm Allison Best, and I'm a photographer. You're tuned to HPR2 Hawaii Public Radio. Join the conversation on Twitter. Talk back to your radio at HI Conversation.
Helping people.
It made me feel good.
Taking care of people.
It's just something that
I wanted to help.
Hi, everyone. This is Bob Wehrman. It's time for The Benevolent Mind, our quest to discover the spark that ignites giving. Harold L. Castle was a man who saw through time. Terry George, president and CEO of the Castle Foundation, shared some interesting facts about Mr. Castle's foresight.
The one thing Harold Castle made very clear when he set up the foundation was, number one, that it would serve Hawaii, and number two, that it would be perpetual. For most of the history of the foundation, we were willing to look at just about anything. Hawaii Lowell College, Symphony, Bishop Museum, Oceanic Institute. In fact, you name just about any preschool, public school, private school on this side of the island, they've probably gotten some support. He certainly lived in a very different era than we have now. He wanted there to be a measured amount of residential development, but he felt as part of building a good community, you needed to have places for schools, which he donated, places for parks, places of worship. He was a man of vision, and I think part of the benevolent mind is to have a vision of a better world that you want to contribute to.
Harold L. Castle, a man who chose to bring to life his vision of the future in Hawaii. Our program is a production of Hawaii Public Radio and is sponsored by the Hawaii Community Foundation, believing for 100 years that philanthropy is all about you.
And while we're remembering benevolence, we know that HPR sustaining members are the heart of this station. They know their monthly gifts mean a steady, predictable income for the station and that we couldn't survive without them. Sustainers are a big part of the reason HPR can come to you daily, so please take the health and well-being of this station seriously and pledge $10 a month to keep your public radio station strong. Keep HPR coming to you every day by calling us at 955-8821 or become a sustaining member at hawaiipublicradio.org. And thanks.
Tonight at 5, it's The Body Show with Dr. Kathy Kozak, and I suppose we could say cause, prevention, and cure. And the topic is thyroid cancer.
Well, yes, it is. We're going to talk about thyroid cancer and also how you get involved in a clinical trial. So we're going to talk with an expert who runs these trials, because not only is thyroid cancer something that we're studying pretty in detail right here in the islands, but a lot of people want to know, how could they ever find out about clinical trials? How would they know if they are someone who might be eligible for it? And what is done right here locally to help them with their diagnosis of cancer?
It seems like sometimes out of the blue you get a letter. That happened to me. They were doing a survey about men of a certain age with certain problems in an overall cancer study, and I thought I was just picked at random. Is that how it happens sometimes?
No. Well, with clinical trials, you actually have to have a diagnosis.
Uh-huh.
And we're going to talk about how, if you get diagnosed with thyroid cancer, how does that lead to treatment, and how would you know if you were eligible for a clinical trial? And most importantly, what good is that going to do for you? Is that going to help you? And will it change the course of your illness?
And for something like thyroid cancer, is that as mysterious as, say, pancreatic, or are there more specific things you can nail down to get to the cause?
Well, the lucky thing about the thyroid is that we can feel it externally. Your pancreas is deep inside the belly, so we really can't feel it if it has a lump or a bump or a mass. But the thyroid is in the neck, and we can actually palpate that, mm-hmm. and doctors can feel it. So there's good news. We can catch thyroid cancer a bit earlier.
And so the chances for a positive outcome are a lot better.
Absolutely.
Okay, well, here's to much better outcomes. Thank you very much, Kathy.
Thank you.
That's The Body Show with Dr. Kathy Kozak, tonight at 5. Earlier in the show, we asked you about a hospital that was established in Kaka'ako back in 1901 to handle victims dying of bubonic plague from the Chinatown epidemic. After the last plague victims died, it took on tuberculosis patients and others suffering from diseases which modern medicine of the early 20th century could not yet heal. It had been known as the Victoria Hospital Association, but changed its name to the Honolulu Home for Incurables. Even by the maudlin standards of the time, after 5 years, it was considered just too downright gloomy, and a new charter was drawn up, and with it, the name was changed. It moved to its present location in 1902 with a purchase of 16 acres of land for $9,000. It continued to grow, and by 1949, it housed its peak of 646 tuberculosis patients. As TB became curable, it shifted focus to long-term care, and it still does today. Its name since 1906, Kaimuki's Leahy Hospital. And we had a winner who knew that, Kalani Matsumoto of Kaimuki, probably looking right at the building. Well, it's 8:48. That's today's quiz. If you have one, you can send it to talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org. Whether you're Hawaii-born and raised or have just lived here for a while, no doubt you've heard many legends of these islands. Some of them are pretty chicken skin and some are quite delightful, or many are a combination of both qualities. And, of course, children are always curious, and they want to know about the legends of this wondrous place. So what's the best way to let our keiki learn about Nā Mo'olelo? Well, Gabrielle Ahuli'i Ferreira-Holt has written 4 volumes so far in a wonderful book series called Hawaiian Legends for Little Ones, and she joins us in studio this morning. Aloha, Gabby.
Hello. Thank you for having me.
So I'm going to take a guess that when you were a small girl, you heard that wonderful song, Keiki o Ka Aina, and it sort of got the ball rolling for you?
Yeah, totally.
So you heard the song, and as you grew, what's the first thing you wanted to do? You heard the legends, you wanted to pass them on. You have Hawaiian kupuna too, right?
Yes, yeah. So I recently graduated from UH with a degree in library and information science.
Mm-hmm.
And so I sort of did a track of school librarianship and Hawaiian and Pacific librarianship. And during my time in school, I realized there's so many resources available to us as Hawaiians to sort of learn our own stories. But the accessibility is the issue. And there are ways of, like, reading these legends that, for me as an adult, is a little bit, like, heady and hard to understand. So for children, it's even more difficult.
If you hearken back, if I may, for a moment, what's the first legend you remember hearing? And how did it affect
probably
you?
One of the Maui stories. Mm-hmm. I think Maui fishing up the islands, that's a pretty common one for everyone here growing up to have heard. And I definitely have a very clear memory of in kindergarten, our teachers reading us that story and us like acting it out.
Mm-hmm.
And we had like a canoe made out of wooden blocks.
Right.
And so when you have that performative aspect of it, it definitely ingrains it in you.
So you wanted to learn more. And then I guess the next one is, what's the first legend which really gave you chicken skin? A little bit of, when you're a child, scary stories can be fun, but they can also be a little too scary.
Yeah, I think, I don't know, just recently, not recently as in like 2 years ago, the story of Hi'iaka coming to Panaeva.
Mm-hmm.
And
the little sister of Pele.
Yeah, and there's a sequence in which Panaeva like cuts off heads of ghosts and tries to drown her in blood. And that like image is so visceral and so evocative, and that really gave me chicken skin.
So, of course, as an author of a series of children's books for little kids, you're trying to walk the line between interest and not scaring them too much.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
The story of Mahina is interesting. You've written about Mahina. And
yes.
If you go from the more intense adult version, if you can backstory that for the audience.
Yeah, so Hawaiian storytelling is so dynamic, and there's so many versions of different legends. There's no one definitive version. And that was kind of my process of researching for these drafts. And so for the Hina legend, where she's initially living here and then she goes to live on the moon, the reasons why she lives on the moon vary. So sometimes she's sort of a victim of spousal abuse or familial abuse, or even just sort of manipulation from her village, her villagers or her, you know, her community, where they want her to pound the kapa for them because she's so good at it. And so because she's such a good person, she takes on more than is probably
Almost parallel to the archetypal story, which shows up in Western myth as Cinderella.
Right, exactly.
But for small kids, it's tragic that so many small children find themselves in households where there is abuse. So you almost don't want to bring it too close to home, but you want to let them know that there's people who've been in similar situations.
Right,
So how did you couch it for Mahina?
I sort of couched it in that she wanted solitude and she liked peace and quiet. And the thing about Hina is that we believe her to be the person who, if we're traveling at night, that's who we ask for protection. So that idea that ultimately she's all about protecting people and she ultimately cares about people, I think that's really what I wanted to stick to. That concept of she is sort of a guardian of
us. Feminine energy, too.
Yeah, feminine guardian energy, absolutely.
Is there much positive male energy in the Hawaiian legends? I know there's like Kamapua is almost the archetypal male chauvinist pig.
Yeah, I think Maui is pretty ultimately positive. Everything he did was pretty
for the benefit.
Yeah, like, you know, it's not in this series, but him, you know, the story of him catching the sun and slowing it down. It was really because he could see that nobody's kapa was drying and things weren't thriving as they could be. So he observed problems in his community and tried to solve it.
And then there's the archetypal. It's almost, I mean, in modern ways, sometimes you have the parent who might be abusive in one way but never wants to admit they're wrong. And so they have a temper tantrum or do something to harm the child physically or mentally, and they come back and give them gifts to show everything's fine, but they never admit that wrong. That sounds a little bit like the temper of a certain goddess.
Well, that's what I like about Hawaiian legends, too. There's so much nuance in them. Mm-hmm. You know, we never think of Pele as one way, or we never think of Maui as one way. And I think it's so humanizing, and that's what makes the legend so interesting.
Heiakua lilio pele la, as the song said.
Yeah.
A jealous goddess of Pele.
But she definitely has that dichotomy of, she can be angry and jealous, but she also, like, creates new land for us. And she's here, and she's, like, such a powerful presence that we all know to respect.
In the legends, are there ever any instances where Pele actually says, well, I was wrong, and I'm sorry?
Off the top of my head, I can't think of any, but I'm sure there are. And throughout the Hiiaka story, where she's sometimes painted as sort of a villain, she does come to Hiiaka's aid a lot. And it's really a powerful idea that these two powerful magical sisters are like going throughout the islands and defeating evil.
Oh, so maybe she's a Leo. What's the next legend in your series? Because you're making them where little kids really hang on and are interested and want to have more.
Yeah, I'm not sure. I think we have to. So the four that we chose were Naupaka, Hina, Maui fishing up the islands, and Pele digging up Kilauea.
Naupaka was the two lovers separated.
Yeah, the sort of Hawaiian Romeo and Juliet. So I think we might want to continue with ones that are a little bit more well known, just to, you know, prompt more interest, but maybe also branch out into ones that aren't as well known.
But keep the kids interested,
right?
And keep it gentle enough that they'll keep on coming back
right.
for more and learn how to solve problems by what the ancients did.
Yes, exactly. That's important.
Well, thank you so much, Gabby, for being with us this morning. Best of luck and success in the ongoing legends that are generated and are still coming up.
Thank you so much.
Hawaiian Legends for Little Ones author Gabrielle Aholi'i Ferreira-Holt was born and raised in Honolulu. She has a BFA in Theater Design and Production from the University of British Columbia and an MLIS from the University of Hawaii. She currently works at Hanahauʻoli School as a librarian. See our Facebook page, Hawaii Conversation, for more information. Upuae, he manao, I kale kiu, o koke, I kanane, o kaina, o kanoe, o aiai.
Support for Hawaii Public Radio comes from Ala Moana Hotel, offering venues and catering for local meetings, banquets, and events. Rumors Nightclub is now available for private functions, including fundraising events for Hawaii's nonprofits. AlamoanaHotel.com.
I'm always fascinated by the law of unintended consequences starting from good intentions, and the way Jay wrapped it up, it started out as apparently a good idea from Senator Inouye, but
Well, you're talking about the it being the so-called loophole that everyone's talking about that's allowing these foreign fishermen
exactly.
to work on American flag ships, and yet they're not allowed to come off them when they're in port because they can't get immigrant visas because those certain criteria aren't met. It's sort of a catch-22 with that. But he's really asking the big question that's, you know, who's willing to take up the responsibility for these men and not just use the idea that, well, you know, this is a great opportunity for Hawaii and having its fishing fleet here, a really important part of what we need. But who is going to be able to look after these men, even though they know they're doing better than they are at home? That's not justification for the way they're being treated.
Getting federal and state to step up to the plate.
And he's also asking that, the fishers themselves take some responsibility for that in the name of a longtime maritime tradition. That's going to do it for us for this Monday morning. We're going to be back with you tomorrow, and we're going to talk about the recently announced draft from the Hawaii Interagency Biosecurity Plan and what shifting invasive species protection offshore would look like. Darcy Oishi, the Department of Agriculture's Biological Control Section Chief, will be here.
Plus, we'll look ahead at the Honolulu Chamber Music Series upcoming season.
You can let us know how you feel about what you hear on the show or anything at the station. Call our TalkBack line at 808-792-8217 or email us at talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org.
If you missed any of the show, want to pass one, find them on the conversation page with links to more information. I'm Bill Sage.
I'm Beth Ann Kozlovich. We'll see you tomorrow with more of The Conversation.